Are you sick of government lackeys who say you didn't build that?
Are you tired of elitists who think you need a government permission slip for everything? Everything you do is an A to B conversation, and the government should see their way out of it. Create true free markets by adopting the BIPCOT No Government License. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows use or modification of any product, service, or software except by governments or government agents.
Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network on theconsciousresistance.com and solpodcast.org. So Peaceful Anarchism is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. This allows reuse by anyone except for governments and the agents thereof. You can find out more information for this at BIPCOT.org. So today, I'm delighted to have R.L. Breyer coming in from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's an anarcho-capitalist and voluntarist, and you can find his stuff on Pittsburgh Hodler, Pittsburgh Hodler, H-O-D-L-R, on YouTube, Steemit, Facebook, and then on Twitter, he's at rbryer23, Breyer, B-R-Y-E-R, 23, on Twitter. And we're going to talk about his recent book. It's called Blockchain Project Renaissance, and it basically discusses how he came to blockchain, how he got into it, defines basic terms, his personal experiences with it, and he talks a lot about decentralization and what that's about. So we're going to talk about that, to get into what's in the book, and how he came to be an anarcho-capitalist. So, RL, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Danilo, it's a pleasure to be here with you tonight. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I heard you. I think you messaged me on Facebook, and then you sent me your conversation with Stephen Clyde, I think it was, right? The Peace and Liberty guy.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it was a great conversation. I really enjoy his podcast as well. So I'm like, well, let's get him on. You know, I love supporting people who like produce content, like either podcasts, YouTubers, or authors, or whatever, rappers even. Documentary filmmakers, you know, people who are enriching the wealth of knowledge. You know, that's a beautiful thing. So, please, let's get into your history. How did you come to anarcho-capitalism?
I got into anarcho-capitalism when I was studying, still in school at the University of Ohio State. I was getting into politics at that point, and I still thought, you know, politics, you know, we're indoctrinated that there's this political answer to everything, basically, and that's how we're going to save the world or how we're going to create a better world. But in reality, it's just not true. But during that point, I was looking for my, you know, candidate that I supported, and I came across Ron Paul, and I sort of he sort of led me, into a more peaceful, you know, he was all about peace and prosperity and sound money, and that led me to like the Austrian School of Economics, like going down that rabbit hole. I think I first heard him talk about like Murray Rothbard and the Mises Institute. So that led me to basically, you know, the philosophy of anarcho-capitalism and free markets.
Yeah, Ron Paul. Yeah, he was a big catalyst for a lot of people. I mean, not so much for me. I think for me, more was Stefan Molyneux, his YouTube channel, Lark and Rose. And I don't, I mean, I read a couple of Murray Rothbard's writings and books, like Anatomy of the State, Case for the 100% Gold Dollar, What Has Government Done to Our Money. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful writing, the way he describes it. Very clear and crisp. And yeah, and then other people influenced me, Walter Block, and yeah.
I'm a big Hans Hoppe fan too.
Yeah, I have a few of his books. I haven't read them yet though, but I think I've heard some of his talks. Yeah, he's a great guy as well. So
yeah, after I read Man, Economy, and State with Power and Market, I was like, there's no turning back for me. So that was like my conversion. So it, like a lot of people, I think, you know, as soon as you read that, it's kind of no turning back. At least for me.
Actually, that reminds me of a meme. I guess more like a cartoon of, you know, you see a kid in a bookstore, and mother's like, okay, pick out whichever book you want. And he picks up, you know, some Murray Rothbard book, like Man, Economy, and State. And then all of a sudden he turns around, and you see the yellow and the black, and he looks at his mother. Taxation is theft. You have no power over me.
I've never seen that one. That's awesome. I've never seen that.
So, yeah, it's amazing.
That's funny.
When you say there's no turning back, like, I mean, yeah, very, very rarely is you see the progression, you know, from anarcho-capitalist, like, back to conservative or back to liberal, right? You don't see that, right? It's a one-way street most of the time.
It really is. It's like you the light bulb goes off and you're just not going to go back. So, I mean, once you find out, you know, it's the best, it's the peaceful way to just, you know, cooperate with society, you know, get along with society overall. I mean, right. It's not just, economics is everything around us. So right. it's just the way to go, I think. So
right. Or one T-shirt that Adam Kokesh was wearing, I love, which is "Freedom is the answer. What's the question?"
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, in what case? In what case is initiated aggression or coercion justified? You know, is there ever a situation where that's necessary? And yeah, I would argue no. So that's awesome. Yeah. I mean. Yeah, it's just I find it fascinating how, you know, to hear different people's journeys. You know, we all come from such diverse backgrounds, such different places, and you know, and we converge on this philosophy. You know, liberal or conservative, or some people even socialist. You know, background, and you know, for me, my family is heavily Democrat, and my mother would even describe herself as socialist, and so that was a sort of a lot of heated discussions in my household when I was learning about this stuff. And, but then I, you know, became to realize like there's no sense in arguing, you know, it's like once you begin to understand this stuff, to me, it's just about, educating the individual, you know, that's why when I tell people what my podcast is about, I just say philosophy, economics, and morality, right? That's what I teach. That's what we all teach, you know, and how could you be against that?
Yeah. That's really what it is too. I mean, just morality, how to be a moral human being, you know,
right.
Someone who isn't aggressing against other people and, you know, stealing their property and stuff and doing things at the barrel of a gun. So,
right. Yeah. And how most people understand what basic morality is. It's just that for some strange reason, the giant exception in their mind is the state, right?
Yeah.
Everything is subject to the universal laws of morality. Except the state, right?
Yeah, it's like that thing where if you put like a list of things that like you would ask somebody, you know, could you do this to someone, and they would say no. But if you just put the state in there instead of the, you know, a person, it's like it just changes for some reason. I don't understand that. Like once it's the collective or the majority, it becomes okay. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a great way to explain it to people is to identify crimes that the state perpetrates is basically if an individual does the very same action, is it a crime?
Yeah.
You know? And if the morality of an action does not change based on the number of people doing it, does it change if you're electing someone to do it for you Or and then they hand that down to their enforcers. Is that, does that change morality? No, of course not. So in no way do the laws of morality ever actually change. It's just that people are blind, conveniently blind to that that reality. So
it's the indoctrination from the onset of your schooling. You know,
yeah.
Schooling.
Oh, it's very powerful.
Yeah.
Very powerful, and only the truly resilient can overcome it and see through the fog. You know. So let's get into your book. Why did you decide to write the book, and what it's about?
Well, a lot of it is about education. Like I try to like put my passions together here, and I've always been one of those people that, like yourself, try to educate people about these things. So, my passion for writing, I have an English degree, so, I've always wanted to write a book. So that was one thing. That was a key to the, you know, this. And then my passion for economics. Freedom, education. I really like to try to teach these peaceful ideas to other people, and just, you know, liberty, the liberty mindset, and just owning yourself, and, you know, not having these overlords to other people. So, and then, you know, just understanding money is it should be so elementary, but it's not. Like, to me, you know, so many people don't understand even the most elementary things about money. So, I think those were all like key factors and decision to do it. And then I saw a lot of people last year, in the blockchain space, being taken advantage of. I wouldn't even call it the blockchain space, really, like the BitConnex and stuff that were like fake cryptocurrencies. I saw people being taken advantage of there, and I was like, it's time, you know, I have to start doing these daily vlogs and then write a book. So, it was the daily vlogs, and then I started getting a little bit of an audience together, and I was talking to a friend, and I was like, hey, if I wrote this book, do you think people would read it? Would you read it? And he said, yeah, I would. So he actually ordered one right there, and I was like, well, I got to write this book now. So I did.
That's awesome. So, yeah, so I wrote down a couple of chapters that really fascinated me that I want to get into with you. So the first one is commodity money and fiat. So please explain those concepts to the listeners.
Okay. Well, historically, commodity money has been like, we sort of talked about this before, you and I, like, precious metals, like specie, like, you know, gold, silver, platinum, things like that. And the opposite or the counter to that would be fiat money, which is what we have today, which is just paper money. Money that is created by the state, which is fiat, literally means by decree. So it's money by decree. So, those are the two, it's this dichotomy between, real money and paper money, really. So, today, you know, we've got I think it just passed $21.5 trillion debt in the United States.
Right.
So, this is another, you know, this was like the reason, Bitcoin and the blockchain became what it is today. So, it's a way, commodity money is a way for us to actually have, value, it's incentive to, save and produce. So if you are holding fiat money, you really don't have any incentive to hold it long term. It literally gives you, an incentive to spend it quickly. So, if you're holding a commodity that you anticipate will, either hold its value or appreciate over time, then you are more likely to hold it over, you know, store it, and it's all about time preference too, which is, you know, the Austrian School of Economics gets into whether you want to hold, you know, spend it now or hold it for a later time, you know, current versus future, you know, spending and production. So I'm trying to do the best I can to explain that. It's a lot to get out in one. Like, the means of, you know, you're not going to be able to have a very productive society if you don't have a good money. So I think that Bitcoin and that the entire network of cryptocurrencies, a few of the best, you know, will over time be much better, and they already are. They're proving to be, you know, more valuable over time. Bitcoin itself is gained over 1% a day for its entire existence. So I think that's a pretty good store of value so far.
Yeah. So this topic of of money and precious metals and fiat is a wonderful topic, I find, to discuss with people who have never heard of any of these concepts, because it is one of the less polarizing of topics. Like, for example, if you were to get into immigration with someone, that's a very inflammatory it's a very inflammatory topic. If you were to get into taxation, another inflammatory topic, right? You know, if you were to get into, I don't know, gender, whatever, laws, maybe that's a very inflammatory topic. But what about the Federal Reserve? Does the common person have an opinion on the Federal Reserve? They don't care what the Federal Reserve is. Not only that, most of them don't even know what it is, right? Yeah. What's their opinion on fiat currency? They don't care and they don't know. Go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump.
That's okay.
It's amazing that, you know, we all use money every single day. Yeah. Like, I don't know anyone that's not using money every day in some regard. Like, you're using it whether you know or not to keep the lights on at the end of the month or whatever, you know, or the beginning of the month, whatever. So it's like, how do you not understand, like, what fiat is even, you know? It's really just brainwashing. Like, they've, and then the whole thing is just, it really is amazing that people aren't at least somewhat, you know, educated on the difference between the two.
So I'm going to mention three books that really influenced me when talking about money. And the first one is G. Edward Griffin, Creature from Jekyll Island. That was an amazing book. Learned a lot about history, Federal Reserve, and how the evolution occurred from commodity money to fiat, right? And that's a fascinating book. Excellent. And then another one is by Mike Maloney, which is called Rich Dad's Guide to Investing in Precious Metals. Excellent book, again, talking about history and precious metals and cycles. I think he calls them wealth cycles. And also what happens over time as the currency gets manipulated by central banking institutions, what he calls happens is wealth transfer. Right, because you know, nothing really changes. Like, all this, you know, the goods, the physical things are still there. What's different is, where is all the wealth? You know, it goes from real things, and then it gets transferred to fiat by decree, by state decree. But as we know, something that, you know, Voltaire said, money will always revert back to its intrinsic value of zero. Right. So it was paper and ink before. You know, the state forced it to have value, it will revert back to zero eventually, you know, because the in his first episode of his documentary series Hidden Secrets of Money, there's one guy said that they tried to figure out which fiat currencies in history have lasted the test of time, which have not died, right? And the guy, he went through all the A's, all the B's, and the C's, and then he realized, wait a minute, they all died. None of them survived, so they have a 100% fatality rate.
I think the shelf life for like a national fiat currency is like 50 years on average. So but the idea of holding a commodity, and I view the Bitcoin network as like a commodity in itself, like this, the entire, you know, it, that's the backing for the network is, Bitcoin, is a application, the cryptocurrency running on the Bitcoin network. So it's kind of confusing to the newcomer, but, what you and I are kind of like trying to bring about here is like Gresham's law is like, good money, bad money will drive good money out of circulation. So, that's what we're seeing with Bitcoin, is that, you know, people view it as a good money, so they'll hold on to it. It's comparatively better than fiat.
And what's amazing about that law is that people act in accordance with that law without even actually knowing what it is. You know,
that's absolutely correct. It's like innate. It's just like built into your DNA or something. Like, you know, you somehow just know that, like, this is not really worth anything, even though you like pretend it is, right?
It's human beings responding to incentives. So you know, the most recent example of the United States was before 1965. The quarters and the half dollars of U.S. currency, I think, and the dimes also, were 90% silver. before 1965, right? And then, so what ended up happening after 1965, they took out all the silver, but they retained their face value of 10 cents, 25 cents, and 50 cents. People innately, immediately understood, or maybe just word spread like lightning, that, that, you know, the 90% silver coins are worth the same as a regular, you know, garbage coins. So why spend the 90% silver coins when you can use the same, the garbage coins yeah. for the same thing? So then immediately people took the 90% coins out of circulation, were hoarding them, and one of the and you know, there was a time where you can go to the bank and they would give you, people would get like 25 cent rolls of 25 cent and 10 cents just for that reason. But eventually, even the bank tellers knew what was going on, so they started taking, they started snatching the 90% silver and replacing it with the newer quarters.
Yeah, it's you know? People figure it out. Yeah. That's another thing. Like today, you can't even. It's like illegal to bring certain amounts out of the country. Like if you were just trying to bring a bag of like old coins out of the country, because the melt value is worth more outside of the United States. So yeah. it should be apparent to everyone, but it's not, you know, and, the government obviously knows that. Like Roosevelt, when he took us off the gold standard in 1931, like what did he give people? Like $25 an ounce or something for their gold. And today, it's worth like, I don't look at the price of gold even every week, but I know it's probably like $11.50 or $12.50, something like in that range normally. So, at least recently. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's just interesting that, you know, since you were talking about the creature from Jekyll Island, since 1913, the dollar's lost 99% of its value, and people just like, I can't figure out why my gallon of milk is $5. You know, it's like, well, there's a reason for that. It's not just like some greedy businessman, like, you know, there's factors of production, and they have to still make a money to keep the doors open, and, you know, the money's not worth anything anymore. So it's not the capitalist's fault. It's the people that are printing endless money or creating, you know, on a computer, just adding zeros to, you know, you can't value doesn't just come out of the ether, you know. There's actually, you know, there has to be some, you have to actually produce more pieces in commodity goods in the market, you know, so there has to be more actual production, more consumer goods to buy up. So it's just like, you can't just, add more pieces of paper. Every country would be obviously just printing money to become wealthy. And well, they try, but it doesn't work. So as we've seen in Venezuela.
Yeah, it's such a strange thing, you know, when there's some kind of economic crisis and the government's response is to print paper with pictures on it. It's like, what? How is that going to help anything?
I don't understand how anybody could buy that, you know? But really, the majority do, or there would be some sort of, like, revolution to stop it. I don't know. I guess that's what the revolution is. You know, this is like a Bitcoin blockchain project renaissance. That's really, you know, the idea of the book. It's like a rebirth, reboot. You know, it's like we have to have a way to, even if we're working just within, like, our own group of, like, peaceful anarchist and voluntarist or anarcho-capitalist, whatever you want to, you know, call it. It's, we can work together to be, you know, be more productive, more peaceful. And then we will be the captains of industry, overall. Like, you're already kind of seeing it. Like, there's like a lot of young millionaires and stuff in the blockchain space now that are like, they are going to be the people that are your boss. So, you know, I think that's a good thing. You know, the smartest people are, you know, the dorks or whatever are going to be like ruling the world. It's like the ultimate, you know,
the ultimate joke, the ultimate payback, right?
Yeah, it's a good thing.
Yeah. And also, interestingly enough, talking about Gresham's Law is, the opposite of that is the case if there is no central bank. Like, right? It's like, imagine there is no coercive institution forcing a people to use a particular money or currency. Then reverse Gresham's Law would take place, and good money will drive out bad, because people would see this money retains value. I'm going to use it, right?
Yeah.
When there's no. Go ahead.
Yeah, people are like, well, you know, we pay our taxes in fiat. It must be real.
Yeah.
So, you know. Things like that, you know, it's legal tender or whatever, you know. And then if you even just look at, you look at, Bill from, what was it, 1970s or something to now. Now it's just a promissory note. Before it was like, this is a certificate, you know, that was redeemable for gold or whatever.
Right.
I don't remember what the exact, you know, thing was, but now it's just, it's a note. Like it's basically like an IOU, right?
Oh yeah. And that reminds me, the third book I didn't even mention was, I think it's called something like, Toxic Currency. Something like that. Toxic Currency. Basically talking about, you know, central banking, but also I learned a lot about everything that's written on a dollar bill or a Federal Reserve note, what is written on it? Like, has a serial number. Why does it have a serial number, right? Like products that you buy in the store. Your laptop has a serial number. Your car has a serial number. Why does a dollar bill have a serial number? Because it's a product of the Federal Reserve. And then it's a note, Federal Reserve note. What's a note? It's like a contract or an IOU.
Yeah.
Right? Like a promissory note. It's a note, right? It's got so a bunch of other interesting stuff. And also another thing I wanted to mention is when I talk to people about precious metals and inflation, central banking, and also people, especially people who clamor for the minimum wage, you know, we need to raise minimum wage $15 because that's living wage. And then I say, well, think back to 1964 when all the coins were 90% silver. The minimum wage was $1.25, I believe. $1.25, I think, in 1964. Now, most people would say, that's horrible. They should be paid more, right?
Yeah.
Now, imagine how much is a quarter, 90% silver quarter, worth today? $4, around $4, $5.
Yeah,
I
believe that. That makes sense. Yeah.
So five quarters, 90% silver, is about $20 or $25 of modern day currency.
Yeah.
And the minimum wage today, $7.50.
It's amazing. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
so there's probably actually less, right? So they're actually comparatively less today.
Right.
The minimum wage is like another thing that really bothers me. People that clamor for the minimum wage, it's like all you're doing is pricing like the least skilled people out of jobs to begin, you know.
Yeah.
It's not good. It's not a good thing. Like, that's another show probably, but
it's very counterintuitive because they're doing it to help the poor, but in reality what happens is the poor are the first to get shafted, right?
You're seeing that today with the computer or the ordering in like fast food restaurants, like the places in like, what was it, Seattle they're doing the $15 minimum wage or whatever. Like now there's like a kiosk you're ordering from or whatever it's called.
The machines, right?
Yeah. The free market is going to figure this out. You're not going to like force them to do something that they know is going to close their doors. I mean, they have to make money. They have to be in the green or no one has a job. Like all these laws, they have an effect. I mean, these laws don't just exist in a vacuum. Like there's actual real world consequences to these things.
Yeah, when people are ignorant of economics, they have this cartoonish idea that businessmen are constantly sitting on a pile of money that they're not sharing with their employees. And if only the government would force them to share, we would all be wealthier. You know?
Yeah, I think that's like the media's and, you know, the banks and the government, they're all like the same class or whatever, the same group of people, whatever you want to say. So they have this like agenda to like brainwash people that the capitalist, like you said, is like smoking big cigars on like piles of cash with his hair slicked back and stuff and like being fed grapes all day by like exotic women. So I just like, you know, but they don't really, they're complaining on their cell phone that, you know, the capitalist made. Like, you think you create that cell phone?
Right, exactly.
You'd spend the rest of your life trying to create that cell phone before you ever had it. If the division of labor is like the best thing in the world, we wouldn't be communicating right now without it. So it's these people are like, I don't know where they come up. You know, they're being brainwashed in the universities today. They're like mostly like communist indoctrination centers today. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, it's weird because they actually pay to be brainwashed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I had a hard time like sitting through that, you know. I'm like sitting there like, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. Like, but Yeah, it was. It's tough to go through that, but I guess at least you get pretty well versed in like countering these arguments.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you do.
It's an expensive education and learning what not to do, I guess.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. All right. So let's talk about ways to acquire wealth. Okay. What would you say that what you talk about there?
Okay, so you have the political means versus the economic means. So today you have like all these people, like we're kind of talking about, that think the way of wealth is like taxing these people and getting into like government office or working for the government, or you know, the political versus the economic means. And then you have like the captain of industry and like the entrepreneurial people that like create all the jobs and produce all the wealth. And then you have like this parasitic class, which is the political class that like sucks all that wealth up. They don't produce anything. So I view blockchain as a way to increase the breadth of production and get people like producing again. So we have all these people, like I said, that are becoming very wealthy or already have become very wealthy in the blockchain space. And I view them as like the great benefactors, like the entrepreneurial people and capitalists as like the benefactors of society. So they'll be the ones in the future and currently are producing like a lot of new jobs. And when you see like government, they don't produce anything. Like I said, they just consume all the wealth that has been produced. So that's kind of what I got into in the book, is like all these, you know, people, like we said, that think that the capitalist is bad. Well, everything you have is because of the capitalist, in my opinion. So
it reminds me of one of my favorite memes, capitalism. You see a picture of a city with bright lights at night, and it says capitalism, the ism that funded all other isms for the past, 2,000 years? So the way I describe that to people is, there's three ways to interact with people, right? First way is coercion and theft. It's also known as the mafia model. Second way is the economic way. That's trade, right? Voluntary exchange. Both parties benefit. Third way is the inheritance model, right? You gift somebody things. Yeah. Now, which way do you think the government...
They do the mob model every time. Your money. I've heard Judge Napolitano describe it like that. I love Judge Napolitano too. Your money or your life. You know, you only have, you're going to give it up, or you're going into a cage.
Right.
You have to do it. It's coercion. You know, so it's really easy to get people to do what you want at the barrel of a gun. But is that how we want to live? Is it, we have an option, right? So if we're really free, opt out. Stop, do your best to like not be a part of their system.
Yeah, and one of our biggest challenges as anarcho-capitalists, as voluntarists, is helping people to see the gun in the room, see the coercion, right? Because all they see is the welfare state, all they see is protection, police making our streets safe for citizens, right? That's what they see, but they don't see the coercion that underlies that, that forms the foundation of all that, and how that's completely, not only is it unnecessary, but is counterproductive. Like you said, it's a parasite. I think I like to describe it like Murray Rothbard says, it's a parasite on the neck of the industrious, siphoning off the productivity of the industrious, right?
Absolutely. And they don't, and it's really not, it's, I think I heard Hans Hoppe say it like this. I listened to a lot of his lectures recently. I heard him talking about the best way to really say it is you want to talk about it as people want to say it's a protection agency. It's an expropriating protection agency. it's a contradiction in terms,
right?
Immediately. Like, give me your money and I'm going to protect you. I mean, it really is the mafia model.
Yeah.
At the very onset,
Yeah.
So like the state doesn't even exist without robbing everyone.
Right.
So, go ahead, sorry.
And then you remind me of another meme. It's like the three levels of criminal. The first level is the amateur, which is like the common thief, breaks into your house or holds you up at gunpoint in the dark alleyway, right? Mugs you. That's the amateur. Second level is the expert. That's the mafia, the godfather, type model, right? They own a couple of blocks in the city. Then you have the third level is the godlike god mode. That's the politicians because not only are they doing the same thing, but they're not only doing it more efficiently, but people actually believe that they are legitimate, that they are necessary for civilization to occur. That without them, we would plunge into disorder and chaos. And that's basically that is the god mode. It's like you need me, or else society would fail.
It is interesting that you meet like a lot of people that claim to be atheists, but their god is the state. They really are, like, in my opinion, like that is their god, you know. So
yeah.
It just seems like normally those are the people that, at least I've met, that like have this appeal to authority, like that total they really just need that like authority factor. Like, obviously it's like, you know, the one that always comes up, who will build the roads? You know, like the people that put the iPhone in your pocket can't build roads. It's just an embarrassment.
It's the flat surfaces. The flat surfaces is what confuses them. That's that they can do microprocessors. They can do you know, advanced touchscreen technology, but the flat asphalt surface, that's the stumbling block.
Isn't that amazing though? Like, how can you even say that with a straight face? Like, I don't know. You have to be so just programmed to believe, like.
Or the irony even better would be if the person texted you, well, how would they build the roads? That would be even better.
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
And they didn't even get and they wouldn't even understand the irony, even if you pointed it out. Wait, what? I don't even what?
I don't understand. What do you mean? I don't know. It's like a concept. So another one that should be so elementary. Like, privatization. I've learned a lot of that stuff from Hop, Hans Hoppe or Hoppe. I don't know how you really pronounce his name, but like all that stuff. Just, you know, even if you're going to talk about like democracy being like, it's really like the worst of the worst. If you're going to talk about like political and having, if you're going to have a government, like, I'm obviously an anarcho-capitalist, like I said, but at least under like a dictator or like a monarchical state, mm-hmm. They have incentive, like, hereditary monarchies and stuff,
right,
to, not exploit all the resources immediately. Like, so they would, you know, they have incentive to, hold on to those things so they can produce over time and not just blow all their resources. Like, democracy is an encouragement for people to come in and just like exploit all the resources as fast as possible because there's term limits.
Right.
So, you know, the idea of democracy is, you know, it's mob rule, but then you get these people in there that are like, our guy's going to exploit all the resources faster than yours.
Or I will rob you. I will rob you 2% less than him.
Yeah. But in reality, it's just like these guys that are like, they suffer from libido dominandi. And then, you know, that's just the lust for power. Like, right, all these people, they're just like power hungry. Cause I mean, like, look at Trump. Trump, I mean, he had all the money in the world, you know, I mean, and then he still wants to be president of the United States. It's all a power trip. These people, they're, you know, it's not, I mean, maybe not like the senators or congressman as much, but like I saw something about Nancy Pelosi, and she came into her position with like $1 million or less, I think, and now she's got, you know, $50 million or something crazy. I don't know what the figure is, but you know, she's got all this money. It's like, wait, she's been a political servant for that long. Like, how does she have all this money? You know, there's all these backroom deals going on that we don't know about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's megalomania, you know. It's people who, you know, it's just like in the Lord of the Rings, you know, nobody can wield the Ring of Power and have a good outcome, right? There's no one, right? You know, it's not just that power corrupts, but it attracts the corruptible. It's a magnet for the scum of society. You know, it's like do you know any of your friends like that are decent, good people, hardworking people? They wake up in the morning, they're like, you know what? I want to control my neighbor. You know, I want to force him to do what I wanted. I want to take his money. You know, like who thinks like that? That's the ultimate minority of people that think like that. You know, sociopath Sociopathy is not a common thing, but it's understandable that they're attracted to positions of political power, right? And I don't know why people are surprised at that. Why don't the best people get into positions of power? It doesn't surprise you that these people, you know, don't bat an eye, you know, dropping bombs on third world countries and, you know, drone bombing people and, you know, just destroying people's lives. Like, you don't see a pattern there?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so, like you said, sociopaths are just attracted to that sort of power over other individuals. It's really sad that, you know, like, people have gone along with it as long as they have.
Right.
And then that we've been brainwashed in America specifically. And then we've now, you know, we've got to spread our goodness to other nations.
Our goodness.
So,
right.
Yeah, our goodness around the globe. We have to make them democratic as well. You know, so there's like very few countries left that aren't democracies. Like, I know we're supposed to be a republic, but, you know, it's like even that you ask 10 people on the street, what kind of government these United States have? And they're going to say a democracy, you know,
that reminds me of a meme. It's like, I think it means, by the way, that's how I think. I just think in memes of, like, it's like, what's stopping us from colonizing Mars? And then it's like, just tell the U.S. government that we found oil there. They'd be like, oh, we got to bring some freedom to Mars. That's gonna get them there.
Yeah, that's funny. That's funny too.
They need some freedom over there.
Yeah, I heard they're running low on freedom on Mars. They're running really low. We got to get up there.
There will be absolutely no delay, no postponement.
Yeah. And then you even have people that like think NASA and stuff creates all the technologies that we use today, and it's like, no, they really don't. They hardly create it. I don't know if they create anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They've just stolen a lot of wealth, you know?
Yeah, and the other thing is that when, you know, innovative and creative people work in the free market, you know, and work for business and have to prove themselves, have to compete with other people, you know, for, you know, with their ingenuity. When those people go into the state and work for the state, you know, maybe in the beginning they're still productive and creative and everything, but that incentive to be better and improve goes down because they no longer have to compete anymore. You know, they're no longer in the market. They're working for the state. And so, yeah, that's why it's completely understandable that all of the best innovation happens in private hands. You know, when people are in the marketplace actually working for private companies having nothing to do with the state, you know.
Yeah, that's why that's what I got into in the book too, like why decentralization is so important. Like, we have this dichotomy outside, which is like the political centralization versus decentralization, statist versus you know, anarchist or individualist or voluntarist, whatever. But in, you know, and then we, in blockchains, we have the same thing, which is like how I think we can like free up the people that really, you know, we got to get people into the right blockchains, like decentralized blockchains where we're going to be able to like, you know, produce again to where the good people have a place to go to really create. Like, even art and stuff today is like, you know, none of the great, nothing great. The theory of relativity wasn't done by state dictate and stuff like that. You know, right. Things like that.
Right.
You know,
right.
So like you said, you know, you have to have competition. And as soon as you go into the state, you just become like this lazy. Like, it's another thing. Like, you want to talk about like law and stuff. You know, in all the government, you know, it's all positive law. You have all these people. Like, we need like private law society where these people, you know, the best people, where, you know, we have people that are already like pillars of their community, like making these sort of judgments, not people that are like wanting to, like we've talked about, just roll over people with bad judgments, you know, and like throw innocent people in cages and things like that, you know. So I think it all like ties in together. Like, we got to like make sure that we use like just decentralized, you know what I mean? I think that's so important today.
Yeah, definitely. So, let's talk about this chapter that it's called Savings versus Consumption. So what did you get into in there?
Yeah, that's just another sort of like thing about like the production, just making sure that we like have a reason to save, you know. If we're consuming all of our everything we produce, then what kind of future do we have, you know? So that's another thing, like the Keynesians think that you can just consume. They preach consume, and that's why they feel like just printing money is a good thing, because they will get you to spend it if you feel like you have wealth. But you know what I mean? But if it doesn't have any value. But we need savings. You know, a lot of people don't have any savings today in America. So we need incentive to save, though. So if people are buying specie or they're buying cryptocurrencies, they actually have a valid reason to save.
Right.
It's all about like time preference and
right.
You know, holding on to your the fruits of your labor. Like, you don't have to go blow your money every week. You know, save, but do you? I mean, what's the incentive to save if you know that it's losing money holding it? So, being able to put your money into things that like commodity money, which I view the blockchain and precious metals, they're, you know, alike. I think, you know, if you're in a good project in blockchain, that it's definitely a reason to hold on to your money and not go blow it every week like a lot of people in America do.
Yeah. The incentive for spending your money or your currency is definitely understandable given our inflationary environment, right? Like you can see this is very apparent, very in your face when you look at countries who are undergoing hyperinflation, like Venezuela right now, or even you know, Weimar Republic, Germany, you know, so many mm-hmm. different examples, Zimbabwe, and basically the people. Like, you know, most people understand, like, right now, people, when they work, they get paid weekly or biweekly, right? That's understandable. But in a situation of a hyperinflation, people cannot wait even a week because the value of their currency will depreciate so much that they're going to lose all that purchasing power. They want to get paid every day. And so right when they get paid, it's like a hot potato. They want to get rid of it. You know,
I gotta get rid of my money.
They gotta get rid of it, you know, and so it's understandable. It's, you know, it's just just humans responding to what's going on in their environment, right? So what's the solution? You know, we want to put the fruits of our labor into a storage facility that does not depreciate at all, that actually appreciates, right? And so that's where precious metals and, you know, cryptocurrency comes in, is that These are mediums of holding wealth that are not, you know, governed by the state or not state decreed. And so, you know, people flock to them because of their value for storing wealth, right? And that's why precious metals have been used for thousands of years, not because the state forced people to use them, but because people found them to be useful for trade and for holding, storing value, right? And one thing I was, you know, to illustrate the idea of fiat currency and how worthless it is. I like to tell people this. I used to tell people this when I worked in my acupuncture clinic. I said, a $1 bill to store, transport, like to print, store, and transport, costs about 6 cents. A $1 bill, right? Paper and ink, right? That's it.
Yeah.
$100 bill, I asked them the same thing. How much do you think that costs to store, transport, and print? 7 cents. You know why? Because it's got two extra zeros, so they got to use more ink.
That's like the best way right there to explain that to someone.
And when
right?
I tell them that, their eyes widen in shock. They're like, what? This is what I've been busting my butt for?
That's why we have to stop trusting these people that are creating the money and put our trust into math and algorithms, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we don't need to trust people anymore with our money. We have math. We have blockchain. We have, you know, we have cryptocurrencies that run on blockchains that are based on math, you know? So we really, you know, we don't need people anymore to coin – to coin
yeah.
our money, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And like you said earlier, it's kind of funny because that example you gave about like debasing like the metals and stuff and like putting less and less into them. Like today you pick one up and it's like, I can't believe how light some of these coins
right.
are. They're like plastic.
Right. Right.
And plastic. I think that they really feel like it to me. They're like completely weightless. So you go back to like, I think it's like the Roman Empire even, that's what they did back then. That's how the ridges on the coins began, I think.
Right.
They're like picking them off, like taking little pieces of the value away,
yeah.
whatever those indentations are called.
Yeah.
I don't really remember. But yeah, so it's just like, this is history, you know? This uh-huh. is another problem with like American institutions and just schooling, which is, I think, it came from the German, the Prussian Empire.
Yeah.
You know, they've schooled people to not understand this stuff, you know? So, I lost where I was going with that, but the entire system has been like created to like confuse us and like just give us this, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, trust, just the trust, you know, this like, I'm trying to think of the best way to put this, like just, it's like hubris almost, like just like believing in these people that are like just, oh, I can be uneducated about it, you know, it's not going to hurt me, but it is,
yeah.
you know, whether you know it or not, like it is hurting you, you know.
Yeah. So, all right. So now let me ask you before we sign off, so given that you wrote a book on blockchain technology and cryptocurrency, what is your perspective on cryptocurrency versus precious metals? Because I already know your perspective about fiat. So cryptocurrency versus precious metals, how do you rate the two? And do you classify one as more important than the other? So what's your view on this?
That's a good question. Like, I still think specie is, you know, precious metals are going to be, like, important. Like you said earlier, those have been money for millennia.
Mm.
So it's not just going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be good to like hold both.
Mm.
So if you're talking about like trying to preserve your wealth, I wouldn't put all your eggs in one basket.
Right.
I'm not a financial advisor. But
disclaimer.
Yeah, disclaimer. I am not a financial advisor. But that's the way I view it. Like, especially for people that hold like a substantial or decent amount of wealth, but even the people that don't and they're trying to get there, like, you know, this is like what I'm talking about in the book. You have to like begin somewhere. So there's got to be a way to store, you know, start to save.
Mm-hmm.
So, I view them both as very, very important. The less fiat you can hold, the less paper, you know, debt money,
yeah.
it's based on debt. It's printed out of debt, so even the money from the onset it's debt, you know? I mean, I think that's why we can never, people are like, we gotta get somebody in there to lower the deficit and start paying back this debt. Well, you can't pay it back, it's created out of debt, you know? So you're never gonna be able to pay it back, it's literally created out of debt. So, yeah, so I think holding both those would be like the best way. I do think though, over the next, like, 15 years, we're going to see, I hope we can go back to this in 15 years, and I'm right. I think you're going to see like people really pouring into blockchain. I think it's going to be like as important as the internet, or I really think it'll be like more important than the internet, because we have internets, you know, that are on the blockchain. So, you know, that's another way we're going to be able to privatize everything. So, I think that they'll both be very important, but as an asset class, I think cryptocurrencies will be like, there's going to be all of these people that they become very, very wealthy. Like these, you know, the ones that are in the right cryptocurrencies, because I'm not going to say you have to do your homework. I get into that in the book too. You can't just like throw your money like darts at a, you know, or, you know, at a dartboard. You got to get into the right ones. So I like Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, EOS. Those are the big ones for me. Bitcoin Cash, I'm starting to become a believer in. So I don't know. It's like you have to be in one or the other in that community, Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash. But I think they're both like – they both have utility right now. So I just think that those over time will be like – they'll be like gold, silver, platinum, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're gonna be like, those will be like the new thing, but like holding the ones that have been money for millennia are, you know, it's just, you can't have a more safe bet than that. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. So it's, those are very, they're both important. I don't really have a, I don't have anything against, the old money.
Yeah. So talking about, you mentioned, people pouring into blockchain. The first thing I thought of was, I think that's true. But I think that the major stumbling block, but it's, I think it's being overcome now, is making blockchain and cryptocurrency user friendly. Like, mm-hmm. like just as easy as, you know, going to the store and with your dollar bills and buying, you know, eggs. Just as easy as that, people need to understand how to go to the store and buy with Bitcoin, right? So once it gets to that level of comfort, of intuitive, like that your grandmother could understand it, then everyone's going to adopt it because it's so much faster, so much easier, and also it appreciates.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't lose value, you know?
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. It's like open source, so like some like genius 14-year-old kid could be in his bedroom right now creating like an app where, you know, we're going to use that. It's called DApps, decentralized applications. So we're like, this kid could be in his bedroom, like I said, working, coding some application, you know, on one of these blockchains. It's like going to change the world. And, you know, I've said, I think it's going to be like important in like cars, even like today, a lot of cars are hackable. I think that there'll be a blockchain, you know, solution to that. I think that'll happen really fast if somebody gets on that. I want a little bit of that, but I think that'll be important. Like I think it's going to be used in like so many different ways.
Yeah.
And, but you know, I just don't want to see it co-opted. Like, I don't want to see the centralized institutions and stuff come in. Like Ripple is like the banker blockchain. It's really not even a blockchain really. So I don't want to see all these people come in and like, co-opt it. You know what I mean? It's important for people to get into the decentralized projects.
Yeah. Yeah. The, so I also thought of, Mike Maloney in, goldsilver.com. He has this Hidden Secrets of Money documentary series. And one of the episodes, I think it's 8, he talks about the German hyperinflation, and he visited the German central bank. And he saw, there's like a museum there, and he saw the printing press that printed all the money right at that time. And he was saying, he's like, just look at this thing, you know, paper's going through it, combined with ink, and they're just printing the stuff, that the politicians are just printing the stuff, laughing all the way to the bank, just printing, you know, and of course they give, you know, some of it to their friends and, you know, enrich themselves and all that. But that's how easy it is to create money, right? That's before all internet and digital stuff. But how easy is it to create precious metals, gold and silver? And I asked my patients this: how do you think gold and silver is made? Nobody knows, right? So there's two ways that Mike Maloney says that gold and silver can be made, or precious metals in general, is the collision of two neutron stars or a supernova. now, how well do you think the state can control those events?
Yeah, well, they probably tell you they can do it.
So that's why I love precious metals, because it's here, it's not going anywhere. You can't destroy it. Doesn't rot. Doesn't wither away. You know, you drop a bar of gold to the bottom of the sea, come back in 100 years, it's still there. Do the same thing with paper. Within a couple of days, maybe a week, it's all disintegrated already. So
they both have pros and cons. Like, the one thing I would say is, like, it's nice in like the cryptocurrency space is that you could, like, you're able to take your entire wealth across the border.
Oh, definitely. Oh, I love that.
Holding on to it.
That's great. That's one of the biggest advantages of it, is transferring value over long distances instantaneously.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. That's the beauty of it. Like, but like you said, like, if you had your phone, you had your wallet on your phone, and you didn't have it backed up, you couldn't throw it into the ocean like you could a gold bar. So they all have pros and cons.
Yeah.
Definitely. But except fiat, it's just garbage. So.
or as,
literally trash.
Or as, Robert Kiyosaki, you familiar with Robert Kiyosaki? He's the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, the original series. He teams up with Mike Maloney, has some YouTube videos, and he calls fiat money toilet paper trash. He's like, and one of his best quotes, I love, cash is trash. I love it.
It really is. Just to circle back real fast, we were talking about Venezuela earlier,
and
we've talked about the Weimar Republic and how they debased the currency and started printing like crazy.
Yeah.
That happened in Venezuela, and they are using Dash down there. Like, that's become like a huge thing. Have you seen that documentary yet? Somebody put out, I forget the guy's name.
Yeah, I did hear about that they're really going towards cryptocurrency. Yeah. I did hear about
that. So we're seeing, like, I think it's, like, just as important in first, you know, industrious nations, cryptocurrency, but in the places where, you know, a lot of people don't even have access to bank accounts, or they charge the poorest countries in the world the highest rate to send a wire transfer things like that.
Right.
You know, it's just like completely upside down. Like, they're really just like trying to keep these people down. So, you have a smartphone, you can send your cryptocurrency, and now you can buy a bag of grain, and now you can produce a farm. Yeah. For the people around you, and then you lift yourself up. So I think that's like huge. You're going to be huge.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. Well, wonderful conversation, RL. So before we go, I always ask my guests, what is your favorite quote of all time?
Oh, man. My favorite quote of all time. Oh, dude, you just stumped me on that. I wasn't ready for that one.
I know. I pop it on everyone when they come.
My favorite quote of all time. How about something? I was just going to say something. I'd say something.
Well,
like,
yeah, it's fine. It could be something.
Can I keep it to one word? One word? Decentralized.
All right. That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
Decentralized.
Yeah, I'll just say that.
All right. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as Jeff Berwick says, you know, we're not necessarily against government. All we want is decentralization. So we want, instead of just, you know, what is it, like 270 nation states or governments, we want 8 billion governments. Everybody is their own government. They're a self-government. They self-govern themselves, right?
Every household is their own government, right?
Exactly, exactly, yeah. Or you could also say, in relation to your neighbor, you are an anarchist, but in relation to yourself, you're a monarchy, right? You are a master of yourself, but you're an anarchist toward your neighbor,
which
is an interesting way of looking at it as well. So, yeah, wonderful conversation, RL. So,
I had a good time. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. So, before we go, please reiterate the ways that people can contact you if they want to find out more and get your book.
Okay. Twitter at rbryer23. You can DM me, rbryer23. If you want to get a hold of me, get a copy of the book that way. On Steam it, at Pittsburgh Hodler, one word. Also, let's see here. Also on Gmail, if you want to just order one through my email, at Pittsburgh Hodler, or Pittsburgh Hodler at Gmail. So Pittsburgh, HODLR at Gmail, and we'll set up a way to get you the book.
Yeah. Yeah, check out the book. Check out all of this stuff, YouTube, Steam it, Facebook, Twitter. I think he's doing great work, and looking forward to the second book. Because, you know, we need more content creators. You know, the more content creators, the better. It's just increasing the wealth of information, you know, increasing the knowledge in society. And it's never, never is a bad thing. You know, we don't defeat bad ideas by suppression. We defeat bad ideas with good ideas, with good arguments. Right.
Yeah, it's like that idea, you know, that T-shirt, we've been talking about memes and stuff. Idea is so good, they must be mandatory. That's the state, the state idea.
Yeah.
So we don't need that. We need cooperation voluntarily, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Good ideas don't require force. You know, it's like that's just it. So yeah, wonderful talking to you, RL. So yeah, please, people, check him out. He's doing some good stuff. So thank you for listening. This is Peaceful Anarchism on the Voluntary Virtues Network. On theconsciousforresistance.com and solpodcast.org. Wishing all of you have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this content and would like to see more of it, please feel free to donate and help me interview other fascinating people. You can do so through Patreon. That's patreon.com/peacefulanarchism to help me out. $1 a show is all I ask. If you feel so inclined to donate more, please feel free. It will only assist me in spreading the message of freedom and volunteerism that much farther and that much more efficiently. You can also donate to my Bitcoin. My Bitcoin address is in the description to my videos as well as on my website, peacefulanarchism.com. And while you're on my site, there's a donate button to donate through PayPal. If you prefer to donate through PayPal, you can do so with that. But Patreon is a little bit easier for content creators, as you can set up a recurring donation if you so desire. Also, while you're on my website, peacefulanarchism.com, please feel free to sign up, enter your email address, sign up for my newsletter, and you'll receive updates every time I post something, a video or an interview. I do not send out any spam. Or you can also follow me on Facebook, under facebook.com/peacefulanarchism or facebook.com/DaniloCuellar3, I believe. DaniloCuellar3. So either one of those methods, if you are able to donate, I would be most appreciative. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a magnificent day.
Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at getcell411.com. That's getcell411.com.